Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington, and today I have the pleasure of talking with cellist Tina Guo, and wow, it's great to have a chance to talk to you.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you, too.
Your new album, Game On, has been getting so much buzz lately, and it's easy to see why, because it's such a great core sample of some of the best game music, honestly, that's ever been written. So congratulations. It's really fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much. I was very lucky to also work with a great team, so I can't take all the credit for it. But yeah, it was definitely a lot of fun working on that. So much great game music.
I thought we could start with kind of the big picture and then scale it down to the granular level, because I can't even imagine how difficult it must have been to sort of narrow down the choices to the just 14 tracks that are on the CD.
Yeah, you know, originally we were only going to do 10, but it just got, like, you know, there's just so much music. So it really was a collaborative process between myself and also the label, which is Sony, because they also had some ideas. So we kind of, like, you know, bounced ideas back and forth. And then my co-producer, Steve Mazzaro, who works for Hans Zimmer, he's at Remote Control, who co-produced the album with me. So he's also a huge gaming fan. So it was kind of the perfect situation. So, you know, he and I also not really argued, but we also debated on stuff. And we made, you know, all these spreadsheets and stuff. So it was actually a big, you know, it was a big thing just to figure out what music to do. And also originally we weren't really planning on doing medleys, but we just couldn't, we like could not narrow it down to just, you know, one piece of music from a particular, you know, title. So then a lot of the songs ended up being medleys, which I think actually worked out good.
Oh, I think it's fantastic. And I especially loved the medley from Pokemon, and one of the reasons, you know, one of the things that I think people love about listening to game music is that there's this element of nostalgia. And for me, the nostalgia was spending hours and hours watching the Pokemon TV show with my son. So as I heard that theme, it was like, oh man.
Yeah, I know. It's me too. It brings back memories too. And you know, at first we actually thought, like, oh, should we maybe not include that? Because technically that's not from the game. You know, it's from the TV show, from the animated series. But I feel like it's kind of synonymous with Pokemon, you know, just in popular culture. So we just stuck that in there at the very end as kind of a little, you know, a topper.
One of the medleys is just so fantastic because it is kind of like a little core sample of the music in the game. And so I'd love to know who you worked with to make the arrangements.
Actually, it was just two people. It was just myself and Steve Mazzaro, who I mentioned earlier, who is a composer. He works for Hans Zimmer. He's like one of the main, I don't know what you would call it, but like main composers, assistant composers that work with Hans. He recently scored it's called The Boss Baby. It's a DreamWorks movie that I think hasn't come out yet, but comes out very soon. I met him touring with Hans Zimmer last year, so we're going on tour again this year, very soon, starting in April. And he's just amazing because he plays every instrument. So except for the Chrono Trigger track with the really crazy bass part, which was played by another friend of mine who's amazing, but all the other guitar, bass, synthesizer, piano, I don't know, random growling sounds, everything was done by Steve. And I also contributed to some random vocals and growling as well. But yeah, it was really just him and I. That's it.
Wow. Because the themes, I mean, yeah, obviously the themes are what everybody knows about, especially with really iconic games like Halo and Skyrim and Zelda. But once you dig down deep, there are so many other fantastic melodies, and linking them and weaving them in and making those transitions must have been a really fun challenge.
Oh yeah, definitely. And we also did try to work in some original stuff just a little bit, you know, to tie things together, because sometimes it was a little bit difficult if, you know, originally all the music might have been in different keys or whatnot. So just to figure out how to connect them all in kind of a somewhat coherent manner was a little bit of a challenge, but it was fun. And I think in Halo, there's about like a minute and 15 seconds in Halo towards the very end, like before the kind of the recapitulation of the opening type of drone main theme. Mm-hmm. There's like a whole minute of original material. Actually, I threw that in there. I don't even know if anybody would notice, because my passion, I love industrial metal. That's like, I just love playing metal, and I really wanted to work in a section. I mean, that song is already, there's a lot of game music that's already kind of more in the rock or metal vein. Mm-hmm. But I kind of took a random opportunity to stick that in there. I don't think anyone's made a comment about that, so I don't even know if anyone noticed, but oh well, I guess it's good, right?
Well, it absolutely fits. Yeah, for sure.
yeah.
And it fits with the feel of the original soundtrack too, because I remember Marty O'Donnell and Michael Salvatore telling me that after the first Halo game was such a huge hit and the music just took off, they had all these like rock musicians that wanted to come in and jam with them too. So, so it absolutely fits.
That's a relief.
I loved the Tetris arrangement too, because it's like a mashup of, you know, Tchaikovsky and Prokofiev and the Wild Chorus and everything, and it really becomes something pretty grand. I mean, it's really amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, like for that one, because the original, you know, Tetris medley was just a Russian folk song with a very memorable but simple melody. So we were like, oh, how are we going to do this? Okay, we have to just go the extreme opposite. So take something that is very, not basic, but you know, it's like everybody knows that melody, and just try to make it as bombastic as possible. And I played in a lot of youth symphonies when I was a kid, and I remember all the big symphonies with the grand endings. And we thought, oh, it'd be kind of funny to just take it to the extreme where it feels like it's going to end, but the ending just goes on and on and on for like over a minute of all these, builds and then stops, and the builds and then stops, in a very kind of classical, you know, neoclassical manner. So that was fun. And then just to try to go in and create, you know, different styles of playing the melody. So for the Tetris piece, the way that we worked, it kind of varied. Sometimes I would start by kind of recording all of the cello parts first, like all of my ideas, arrangements that way, and then I would send the files over. So for that one, I actually recorded all the cello parts for the entire, medley or arrangement of Tetris first, and then we built like the rest of the orchestration around it, you know, to try to figure out what to do.
Wow, no, it works really well. And like you said, it's funny because it really struck me. It's like Tchaikovsky symphonies where it's like, wait, I just thought of one more thing.
Yeah.
So you never know for sure. Okay, are we done now? Mm-hmm. obviously been playing cello for a really, really, really long time. And it sounds like when you were a kid, you were really required to practice for hours and hours and hours. And I'm wondering what you did as a kid to kind of keep the fun from getting squished out of playing your instrument.
Well, you know, to be completely honest, and I've talked about this before, growing up as a kid, of course, I didn't want to practice. And if my parents hadn't forced me to, literally, I wouldn't have practiced. So, you know, I think to everything there is a price. I possibly met one person before, one of my dad's old cello students, actually, who then went to Juilliard, but that was actually self-motivated and like got up at 6 a.m. themselves every day and wanted to practice. But I definitely wasn't one of those kids. So it was really difficult for me. And it actually never was fun. I have to be honest. It wasn't fun. It was horrible. It was really like it seemed more of like a, you know, a punishment all the time. And I guess I didn't, you know, you don't really see the big picture necessarily all the time, especially when you're young and you're a kid. You just want to go out and play or, you know, do stuff. So for me, like the actual joy and the creativity of music and seeing music less as, you know, some kind of punishment or kind of tool to play notes and more of a creative artistic expression tool, I guess, that didn't happen actually until college when I left home and I was able to start experimenting with different kinds of music outside of just classical music. So it really was a very long process. I mean, I started cello when I was 7. Piano when I was 3, cello when I was 7. So it was a really good, let's just say it was a good decade of kind of like boot camp style technical training, which again, you really do need, you know, in order to play at a very proficient level. You know, that 10,000 hour rule, there really isn't any way of getting around just the, you know, just a pure number of hours that you have to practice something, you know, if it's cello or basketball or whatever. So
yeah, that's absolutely true. And there are people that I've talked with, Aldo Pariso, who's in the Yale School of Music here, makes it sound so simple. It's like, well, once you get past the physical challenges of playing your cello, it's like, that's it. But obviously, there's a lot more to it than that.
It does make things easier, though. I mean, I have to say, like, if, you know, just like learning languages or other things later in life, there are certain things that, you know, as we're developing as, you know, little human beings, it is easier to take in new knowledge, to learn new languages, to learn instruments. So if you do start early and you put in a lot of hours, it's just kind of like a, I don't know, it's kind of a given thing that it not necessarily everybody, because actually my little brother also learned cello, but I guess he just didn't practice as much, like he couldn't be forced to. So he ended up playing a lot of video games, which is why I was exposed to a lot of video games, because every time I was practicing, he was in the next room playing video games. But in the end, it worked out for him too, because now he's a programmer for an investment firm. So he kind of went more of the technology computer route.
So sometimes it takes a few paths. You have to walk down a few different paths to find out exactly what the right one is. But clearly for you, it's cello. And I would love to know about your two cellos, because they just couldn't be more different. You've got the acoustic cello from the 19th century made in Paris, and then your amazing electric cello. So with your acoustic one, how did you choose it?
Okay, so my acoustic cello, his name is Cello Guo, and he was born in 1880 in Paris in a luthier shop. There it was Gand and Bernadelle. They're two great violin, cello instrument makers. So when I went to college at USC, I had a loan from the Colburn Foundation. So they give out loans to students who can't afford their own instruments or don't have an instrument. And so I had a lovely cello from the Colburn Foundation. But when I dropped out of school 3 years into my classical cello studies program, due to the fact that I was missing like more than half the classes, because I was also trying to work and make money at the same time. So it was kind of a catch-22. So I was gone. I started to do some classical tours at the time. At the time, I was still playing mostly classical music. So I would leave for, you know, sometimes a week to up to a month at a time to perform, you know, because I love to perform and also just because financially I had to. And thus I was missing classes. So then I started failing the classes. So I had to choose between either, you know, making money and playing music or staying in school. So the choice was kind of I didn't really have a choice, so I left. And when I left, the Colburn Foundation took back the instrument because it's only students who are currently full-time students are eligible. So I found myself without a cello for, I think it was about 3 months. And I remember I was panicking at the time because I'm like, oh my God, how am I going to afford a, you know, a classical instrument? Because they're very expensive, you know? So I started going around to different shops in LA, to different music shops and just trying out cellos. And when I found this one, this was at the Hans Weisar violin shop in near Melrose in Hollywood, and I think some, you know, certain instruments, they just kind of, I don't know, they just kind of resonate. You play them and it feels right. That particular cello is also a tiny bit smaller than like a normal full size instrument, and I'm not tiny, but I guess I'm 5'3¾", so you know, it felt right for me. And that's kind of a, you know, very long winded story of how I met my cello.
It's interesting because clearly you have to spend so much time with your instrument, and cellos are interesting too because they're almost like people size, like a little person, and they all have their different personalities, and so of course you'd want one that it seems like a really good fit.
Yeah, definitely. You know, one time when I was in college, Yo-Yo Ma came to perform with the chamber orchestra I was playing in, which was an amazing experience. I was so like starstruck and in awe of meeting him. He was such a, you know, incredible person with great energy, but he was so nice that he let myself and a few other of the cellists try out his, I believe it was his Montagnana, so it was like a giant, you know, huge cello worth I think $4 or $5 million. And weirdly enough, when I tried it, I like couldn't even, it was so big that it really felt like for me it wouldn't work, you know, because just with my body size and the way that I play. So it's very interesting, like each instrument is really, you know, really has to find the perfect fit, kind of like, you know, Harry Potter and the Wand. So
yeah,
you kind of
exactly.
Find the one, yeah, you find the one that kind of resonates with you, and it doesn't necessarily work for everybody what works for, you know, an individual. So
yeah, and it's neat because especially with instruments this old or older, like this Guarneri's and Stradivarius, they've got their own little histories too. And I remember what Yo-Yo Ma telling me one time with the cello that he played that had belonged to Jacqueline Dupré. He said it seemed like it remembered her, too. So you've got all these layers. I think that's what makes old instruments just so very interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I do think about that. I, you know, with the cello that I have, I actually don't know anything about the history of it. It is, you know, I'm sure it's been played by quite a few people, but when I purchased it, there was no record, you know, so sometimes I do think about, wow, I wonder who played this instrument. Maybe one day I'll do some kind of investigation and try to find out.
Yeah, that would be super cool. And then on the flip side, you've got this incredible electric cello, and wow. It's just, you get so many amazing sounds out of it. It must be just an absolute blast to play.
Yeah, definitely. So I have actually two electric cellos from Yamaha, which is the brand that I play. And with electric cellos, it's, you know, I always tell people it's the equivalent of what a classical acoustic guitar would be to an electric guitar. So, you know, all the finger positions, I guess there's no frets, but the fingerboard, all the positions are the same, but it's really the electronic element, you know, that makes it possible to process the sound. So it's really, it's, of course, it's also the instrument, but more so the tone and everything, you know, that you're talking about, the different sounds. That comes really from all of the effects pedals. So I run through guitar effects pedals. Sometimes I use pedals through, you know, the computer, digital effects, and also the amplifier or amp modeler that you use. So that's like a whole other world of tone creation, you know, and kind of experimenting with what can be done.
Yeah, definitely. And it's neat to have both of them sometimes in the same track, too.
Yeah,
they really
complement
each other, and it was so cool to see it in your Skyrim video.
Thank you.
With the costume and everything. I mean, I could almost sort of visualize it as a weapon that you don't want to
do. Yeah, it kind of does look like something you could just hop on and fly away on. I wish.
Yeah,
that would be
really
cool.
Or some like really elaborate bow sort of thing that one of the elves would use. And so.
Yeah, definitely.
It sounds like you didn't grow up playing a lot of games except for watching your brother. when did you really kind of get hooked on games and start playing them for yourself?
Well, actually, you know, with my little brother, I did play, I don't know, I don't remember how much, maybe like an hour a day, like not very much. But well, the very first game, I remember this because I had just moved from China when I was 5 years old. My little brother was born here in the States when my parents were in college in Connecticut.
Oh.
So they had him when they were in university, actually, studying music. So he was already here. And then I immigrated out when I was five because they left me in China because they had moved out to go to school and hadn't planned on having another child. So my brother was already here. And I remember the day that I kind of like met my parents in the airport. That's the first time I remember meeting them, which is really strange. But my parents and my little brother, and then we went back to their apartment in Hartford, Connecticut, and there was an Atari. And my little brother's like, oh, come over here. And he was eating Cheetos, which I had never seen before. So he was eating Cheetos. And then we sat down and he was showing me the, it was like a Tarzan game. And I couldn't get him to go over the pond or the lake or whatever it was. It's weird, the things that you remember. That was like my first memory of coming to America was the Atari and Tarzan. And then my parents, like, they had American sliced cheeses, you know, like the yellow cheese, which I guess in China there's just not a lot of cheese. People don't really eat it. Now a little bit more because it's been westernized. But at the time, you know, when I came, and I think that was 1990, it just, I had only eaten Chinese food. And I remember like thinking the cheese tasted really weird and being frustrated that I really sucked at video games. So that was my first experience. And then when we moved out to California, I think I was in like elementary school, Zelda, I think, just came out, this Legend of Zelda, Super Nintendo. So my brother had a system. He played it a lot. And I would sit in with him sometimes and play. We also played Super Mario. Mm-hmm. And then when he got to, like, I think Donkey Kong, I don't know if I even played that. I just, like, watched him. And then he got a Pokemon Snap. And so I really got into that game. I really like that because I like to take photos of stuff. So I'm like, oh, my God, a game where I can just take photos of Pokemon. This is great. So I got really into that. And then now, you know, of course, I've seen some gameplay and whatnot on the different games that I've worked on, you know, playing, recording for. But the game that I have to say I'm the most active in would be, Pokemon Go. Almost to a level that's probably not very healthy, though. I tend to get obsessed with things. So I've already had two breakups with Pokemon Go where I deleted it off my phone. I said, no, I'm never playing this again. This is, you know, I'm like totally getting obsessed. And then I always like put it back on.
Well,
you know, ashamed.
Yeah, well, it's easy. It's totally easy to understand. And now they've got an update.
I love the new update, but it's just, yeah, it's really out of control. So
yeah,
I need to learn to control. I haven't actually played it for like 24 hours now. So I might go after this. I might go try to catch some Pokemon. But yeah, I've refrained myself for a day. So I'm pretty proud.
Yeah, that's awesome. it's kind of, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but you know, on a lot of the games like Skyrim, it tells me that I've played it for like 320 hours. And I'm like, oh my God.
Oh my goodness. Well, hey, you know, I guess everything in moderation.
Yeah.
If there is such a thing, except it's hard to be moderate, mm-hmm. with, you know, with games and stuff. So,
well, you've been right in the thick of the creation process with many, many games, including Journey, which was how I first became familiar with your artistry. And did that lead to other things, or were you already kind of the go-to cellist for a lot of game composers?
Oh, I don't know if I would call myself the go-to cellist, but thank you for saying that. You know, Austin, you know, the composer, of course, if anybody's listening that doesn't, who's like, who's Austin? So Austin Wintry wrote the music for Journey, and he and I met in college at USC. He was there studying composition. I was there as a classical cello student, and we kind of just kept in touch. I believe even before Journey, there was a game, was a Flow that came out before Journey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually recorded on that one as well. So so I did that, and then Journey came along, and at the time we had no idea it was going to be such a big, you know, success. I'm sure you've talked to him about it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we recorded it in his studio at the time, which was just like a pretty small room. We recorded everything on actually the same microphone that I use now, but not a super fancy, expensive microphone. Now he's upgraded, of course, to more high-end equipment, but it was done on a Rode NT1000, which is the same microphone that I still use, actually, for all of my remote recordings and different projects that I do from my home studio. And it was just him and I in the room. Sometimes the game developers, I think one time or two times they came and took some video of us. It felt like a very small and like intimate, project, and for it to have blown up is just amazing. I don't really think anybody was expecting that. The music was definitely very unique, so I was very honored to be a part of it in such a cello-heavy score.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah. I think he said later that it just had to be a cello, and it ends up being almost like a concerto, really, at times.
So. Yeah, definitely. And then I don't remember what year that was, but I think I was already probably playing on some different projects. I can't recall exactly, but with Hans. The first movie that I worked with him on was Sherlock Holmes. So I think that was 2009. I don't know. I think when you live in LA and it is a very small music community, there's a lot of people, but eventually I think everybody kind of gets to know each other, So names are very easily spread around or whatnot. So I'm sure, playing on Journey has helped a lot in ways I probably don't even know, because everything's interconnected for sure.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like a small town sometimes out there with
Oh,
the game
yeah.
composers that I've been talking with anyway, which is
Yes.
really neat, kind of like Leipzig in the 19th century when Schumann and Mendelssohn and everybody were friends. And
Yeah, that's I didn't think about it that way, but that's absolutely true.
yeah, there's been a lot of discussion lately about whether game music is really on par with classical or film music. And we could talk about this for hours, but it seems as though right now people are really becoming more aware of the legitimacy of game music because it is so good and it's so well crafted. And so I think that's really it's a wonderful time, I think, to be involved in game music.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I could talk about that for a long time as well, but to try to keep it as concise as possible, because I do tend to ramble a little bit, I apologize. For me personally, I'm very coming, ironically, coming from a very conservative classical background, which is, how I was raised and what I was brought up in training. And maybe because of that very reason, I am very against I guess I call it bigotry in music, where people, have this idea that their type of music, whatever it might not even be classical, it could be something else, is the only real type of music, and you have to do it this way, and only in a certain way it's considered real music. And I'm like, in the end, everything's music. I mean, music is just a, and it could even be a random mishmash of sound. It's just sound waves, everything's sound waves. So I'm really not into like generalizing about music. I mean, there could be music that's written for a game that I might not personally like very much, or there might be music that I love. So to kind of just group everything together, I really am not a big fan of. But that being said, of course, with technology and the way that things are developing, and also the fact that there's more, money, just purely financially, there's more money in games than actually film and TV combined. And I think that's probably attracting a lot more, I guess, interest in writing music for games and being involved in gaming. It's such a huge, huge industry. And there's a lot of amazing composers who work in all kinds of different mediums, not just in games. So I think there's a big kind of crossover, with all types of, I guess, music making, which for me, I think is awesome because I don't know. I guess I'm a bit of a universalist where like everybody should do everything, and nothing should be separated from each other.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it reminds me of, I think it was Duke Ellington who said, "Man, if it sounds good, it is good."
Yep,
And that pretty much sounds,
exactly.
yeah, so.
It, yeah, exactly. Any genre of music, any style, any type, and back in the olden days, I guess when classical music was more popular, classical music really was the equivalent of our popular music of today. But somehow it's turned into more, not again, not for everybody. I don't want to generalize and be guilty of what I was just talking about, but so I feel like some people that I've met have this mentality where it's like a museum piece mentality where, they're obsessed with, oh, this has to be this way and only this is the correct way and you're being blasphemous or whatever. But I'm like, yeah, but do you realize that back in the day when all of these amazing, crazy composers were performing their own music live or writing their own music, most of the time, they were improvising while they were performing, all the cadenzas, which is like a kind of a little solo piece that an instrumentalist would play at the end of a concerto, which is a showpiece for a solo instrumentalist with an orchestra. Traditionally, all the cadenzas were written by the actual performers to show their own creativity, their own kind of interpretation of the piece, and show their technical skill or whatever it is that they want to show. That was what a cadenza was for. But somehow nowadays, there's like two or three kind of standardized cadenzas that have been written by other people, and almost everybody plays the pre-written cadenza. So it's almost like classical music has lost its creative spark. It used to be so wild and creative, and with like also Paganini, who's probably my favorite performer. Not that I've seen him live, of course, but the stories that I've read, the things that I've heard. I mean, he was the first rock star, or maybe there were people before him too. But with the long hair, he always arrived in a black carriage with black horses. Disappeared the second after he performed. Like it was an entire like aura, and I don't know. That's just very exciting. Women would faint and pass out and scream when Chopin would play. I mean, this was classical music, or what we call classical music now. But I don't know. I guess just over time things get distorted. We forget where it came from and what like the essence was. And I don't know. I just think that's sad. So there's something exciting about working with living composers. People who are breathing and creating now, who are creative. I don't think I've met any composers who are extremely closed-minded or like, no, Tina, you have to play it this way. I wrote it this way. No, like I think everybody's very, everyone's very collaborative because they're all artists, and so it's a very different vibe, when you're able to do things in real time and create new stuff, which I think is I guess a good thing about game music or any music that's being written, I guess, now. So
Yeah, no, it is. It's really exciting, and what is so fun, and what is such a privilege, is to be able to talk to the composer and get their input and get a real dialogue going. Because obviously, we can't do that anymore with Paganini or with Beethoven or any of them. So, wow. So, are you planning a second album now?
Yes, you know, I've been thinking about it. I haven't quite figured out what I'm going to do, but the other issue is usually when you put out an album, or so I've been told, you need to tour some of the material from the album. But right now, you know, in April, I start tour with Hans, and we tour from April through August, so it's a pretty long, it's like almost the entire year. And I'm planning on, hopefully I can get a band together in about a month's time. So by September, I'm hoping to have the live band kind of put together. And that's another thing, like with this album, because it's orchestrated for full symphony, a full choir, and you know, a band and all kinds of random instruments and stuff. We didn't quite think about how on earth am I going to play this live. So you know, that's a whole other thing that I have to figure out. We're going to have to use backing tracks because I can't afford, unlike Hans Zimmer, I can't afford to bring an entire orchestra with me. Minor detail. So we're going to have to figure that out. But once we figure it out, I'm hoping to start playing some shows at different comic cons. Actually, I think that would be fun to do a game music shows at different comic cons, and I have started speaking to a few of them that have sent in offers. But again, I can't, you know, I can't really start doing it until late this fall because, you know, I'll be on the road. So I'm hoping to maybe tour that, you know, we have to see how things work out, but tour that into the spring of next year. And then of course I need to be back in Los Angeles so that I can work on the next album. And I'm not quite, again, I'm not quite sure yet. I would love to do original music. Again, for me personally, you know, selfishly, I love industrial metal, but I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, I also want to see how things go with this album, if we should do a continuation of maybe more game music, or maybe move into TV and movie scores. Although I did do an album already, I guess last year, but there's so much music out there, you know. So yeah, I guess I'm open to suggestions and different inspirations that might come up.
Wow, that sounds awesome. And those are
Thank
all
you.
like really good problems to have, I guess, being too busy
Yeah.
performing with Hans Zimmer that you can't do your own tour.
Oh, yeah, I
So,
know.
Tina, wow, it has been so much fun to talk with you, and I really appreciate your time, and good luck with all of your projects.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk with you.